For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
1 Peter chapter 3, marriage evangelism. If you've been with us, we've been studying the book of 1 Peter. This was a letter written by the Apostle Peter to Christians in the early 60s AD. So this is about almost 2,000 years old. Peter was an apostle. He was like Jesus' right-hand man and was a great leader in the early church after the death and resurrection of Christ. And Peter's writing this letter from Rome, and he's writing it to churches that are in modern-day Turkey. And these Christians that he's writing to, they were under persecution, pretty heavy persecution, because of their faith. His topic that we started in on last week is how we can live as witnesses in a hostile world. You know, it's not just enough to try to survive a world that, as Jesus said, you know, it hated me first and it's going to hate you. It's not just enough to survive, but we also need to carry out the mission that Christ gave his followers, where he said, I want you to go into the whole world. I want you to tell people about my love and my forgiveness. And he says, I'll be with you, but you need to go and tell people and be my ambassadors, really, to this world, where you go out really not as native citizens anymore, but you're now citizens of heaven. And so you're my representative. And so he's talking about how to live as a witness for Christ in a hostile world. And if you remember last week, he looked at a few challenging situations that the Christians were up against. For one, as citizens relating to unjust government. You know, the head of the Roman Empire at this point was Nero. How do we interface with a government that is very hostile toward our faith and unjust? Also, how do slaves live as Christians? You know, they were slaves that had become Christians and their masters weren't, and they were being abused and beaten. What does this look like to live for Christ in that situation? He also pointed to Jesus, who's the ultimate example of suffering injustice. And he's really our model that we look to. You know, when we're slandered, we don't return with insult for insult. When he was reviled, he did not revile back. He did not lash back out. But he kept entrusting himself to God, who judges justly. And so he had a real trust of God the Father in the midst of his suffering. This week, we're going to look mainly at Peter's next audience, and that's wives who had become Christians. Their husbands weren't Christians in many cases. How do you relate to your ungodly husband? And how do you actually be a witness for Christ in that situation? So tonight we're going to talk about marriage. Let's start reading 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. Peter says, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. So he's just talked about how Jesus submitted when he was slandered, abused, and even killed. And he says, you know, you need to look to the example of Christ when you're mistreated, and you need to not retaliate. You need to not lash back. You need to look to his example with your husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste or pure and respectful, reverent behavior, your chaste and respectful behavior. And so you can see the context here. He's talking to Christian wives with non-Christian husbands. If any of them are disobedient to the word, they're not believers, they may be won to Christ by the behavior of their wives. And the challenge that he's addressing is how to live as a Christian and win him over too. You know, this was long before women's rights. The background for this is pretty important. Karen Jobes, a New Testament scholar, shed some light onto this situation. She says, in Greco-Roman society, it was expected that the wife would have no friends of her own and would worship the gods of her husband. She cites Plutarch on that. So yeah, as a woman, you couldn't just go out with the girls and have friends. You know, if you wanted friends, it was your husband's friends and their wives. Those were your options. If you wanted to worship, you worshiped your husband's gods. If this expectation is applied to a Christian wife, it might result in trouble for several reasons. First, the very fact that a woman would adopt any religion other than her husband's violated the Greco-Roman ideal of an orderly home. Because prosperity and well-being were seen as dependent on religious forces, disorder in the home was a threat not only to family but to society. Yeah, this was a superstitious society, so if you started worshiping other gods in defiance of your husband, and then something bad happened to your family, guess who got blamed for that? You. If you start worshiping other gods that your little village doesn't worship, or your town, your city doesn't worship, and something bad happens to our town, guess who gets blamed? You. So you have the whole town, in some cases, mad at you and mad at your husband for his unruly wife who's going off to worship this new god, Jesus, that she's found. Christians were frequently blamed as the cause of public calamity because they introduced a new god, upsetting the religious status quo of the empire. Second, the husband and society would perceive the wife's worship of Jesus Christ as rebellion, especially if she worshiped Christ exclusively. You know, she might be able to get away with adding another god into the gods that this family worshiped, but when Jesus says, you know, I'm the only one, when God says you should have no other gods before me, that creates a conflict. And so it involved setting aside all other gods that they worshiped and followed and worshiping him alone. That would have been seen as a rebellion. Would have been very serious offense. If the wife persisted in her new religion to the extent that others outside the household learned of it, the husband would also feel embarrassment and suffer criticism for not properly managing his household. And so, you know, especially if she starts talking to other people about her faith, they see her heading down to home church, you know, they would be like, you know, that guy's got serious problems, and he's going to feel so ashamed and angry with her for embarrassing him. You know, respect is pretty important to guys. And he'd be losing face in front of everybody he knows. This could seriously damage his social standing, even to the point of disqualifying him for certain honors and offices. He could lose his job in some cases if this was deemed serious enough. And third, the wife's attendance at Christian worship would provide the opportunity for her to have fellowship with other Christians who possibly were not her husband's friends. So, you know, these women, they're thinking for themselves, making their own friends, you know, in rebellion, upsetting the whole household and even the spiritual fabric of society is really how this would have been viewed. So what's she supposed to do? She had no rights. She was not protected. Husband could do whatever he wanted to her, including sending her out on the streets, abusing her physically. You know, what's a wife to do in that situation? Well, this is the challenge that she's facing, and this is what Peter advises her. He says, it's time to switch over to silent witness in some cases. You know, obviously, they had probably already talked to their husband about their new religion. He wasn't interested. And he's like, you know, sometimes it actually does more harm than good to continue to nag him about this, to continue to put this right up in his face. This is already complicated enough. And maybe you need to just show him by your behavior, by your lifestyle, that things are different and that is what's going to make this new faith attractive. You may win him over without even another word by your own behavior. If she becomes a Christian, all of a sudden, she becomes a lot better wife, a lot more pleasant to be around, a lot more serving, a lot more sacrificial, a lot kinder. You know, that's going to speak something to, you know, that's some of those good deeds that we're supposed to do before, you know, the watching world that's going to command the belief of Christianity. And he says this, he says, be submissive to your own husbands. And we need to realize here that even though the context for submission is winning over the unbelieving husband, so it's kind of a pragmatic concern. He's like, I don't want things to go worse for you. Also, I don't want things to go worse for your Christian friends. I don't want this to be viewed as a threat or a menace to society. And we're hoping to win this guy over by your lifestyle. So it's not just a pragmatic or a missiological concern. But when you read the rest of Scripture, it does teach submission, even in healthy Christian marriages. Like in Ephesians chapter 5, where it says, wives, submit to your husbands. As those in the Lord. It goes on, so it says, wives, submit to your husbands. And it goes on to lay out how, you know, this picture of the wife submitting to her husband is kind of like the picture of the relationship that the church has with Christ. And so it's theologically grounded there and in a number of other passages as well. And so we need to look at this subject because, when we hear submission, we need to understand what the Bible is actually saying when it means submission. And we need to look at this in its broader context, even have a category for processing this. So we're going to ask this question here. Is the Bible patriarchal? Is the Bible oppressive toward women? Well, the first thing we need to look at is how do other worldviews treat women? We got to look at the options here. And the Bible, actually, when viewed in its context, is actually quite progressive. this, it's actually, you know, a passage like we're reading tonight would have been viewed as highly liberating. You know, for one, the fact that Peter's talking directly to the women and expecting them to make their own choices. Later on, he's going to call them a fellow heir of the grace of life. He's going to make them equal with men. You know, that would have been totally revolutionary. But from our perspective, especially with the baggage we've got attached to some of these terms, it sounds like, you know, a huge step backward for women. So we want to look at how other worldviews treat women. For one, Talmudic Judaism, which was the Judaism at and shortly after this time in history. What does the Talmud have to say about women? A man's wickedness is better than a woman's goodness. Women bring shame and disgrace. What about this? May the words of the Torah be burned, than that they should be handed over to women. You know, women, you were not to teach the Torah to women. There's actually a prayer from the time of Christ that certain good Jews would pray every morning, and they would say, I thank thee, God, that I'm not a Gentile, and I thank thee, God, that I'm not a woman. And so they were thanking God every day that they weren't a woman. Hinduism, what's the Hindu view of women? Well, Carmody and Carmody, in their book Ways to the Center, here's what they have to say. They say between the first Vedas and the first codes of law, women's religious role steadily declined. A major reason for this was the lowering of the marriage age from 15 or 16 to 10 and even 5. Ooh. This both removed the possibility of education and consequently religious office and fixed women's role to being wife and mother. To ritualize this attitude of devotion, Orthodox Hindu authors counseled wives to adore the big toe of their husband's right foot, bathing it as they would an idol, and offering incense before it as they would to a great god. In Hindu society, women were not eligible for moksha, which is kind of like their version of release into the afterlife. And the best that a woman could hope for was to be reborn as a man. You know, that was like the pinnacle of womanhood, was to start at the bottom of the totem pole for men. The birth of a girl was not an occasion for joy. Hindus attributed it to bad karma in a previous life, and frequently announced this event by saying nothing was born. What about Islam and their view of women? Also pretty negative. Men are the managers of the affairs of women, for that God has preferred in bounty one of them over another, preferred men over women. Righteous women are therefore obedient, guarding the secret for God's guarding. And those you fear may be rebellious, admonish, banish them to their couches and beat them. It's the Quran, Surah 434. Again, on Islam here, Carmody and Carmody say, for many men, the best part of the heavenly garden was the her, dark-eyed, buxom virgins. This is their view of the afterlife. In addition to his earthly wife, each male in heaven could expect to have 70 her. You know, the number 70 is not in the Quran, but it's in a, it doesn't specify how many you get. That's from a commentary on the Quran from that time that's viewed as inspired. They would never be sick, menstruating, pregnant, unless he wished for them to be, bad-tempered or jealous. He'd be able to deflower 1,000 each month and find them all intact when he returned to them. In descriptions of the judgment scene, one sees the reverse of this fantasy. So this is the hell in the Quran. Women are in charge of men, which is a sure sign of disorder. That's their view of hell, where women are in charge. Eastern religion, also pretty savage. Confucianism was largely misogynistic. The woman's role in Confucianism was to obey and serve her parents, husband and husband's parents. She was useless until she produced a male heir. You know, in fact, their view of women has led to, many think, to modern gendercide. You know, this is where, you know, in China, they've got, due to overpopulation, they had a law that you can only have one child. And so if you were going to have a girl, it's a much higher chance of being aborted or just killed once the baby is born. Because if you were going to have one or the other, you wanted to have a male. The ratio in birth of men to women is as high as 130 to 100 in some parts of China, just due to this fact right here, this engineering of the sex. The Chinese ritual of foot binding was a 1,000-year-old horror show in which women were grotesquely crippled from very early childhood, where the feet were actually bound so tightly that they couldn't develop or form properly. The hideous 3-inch-long lotus hooks, which were in reality odoriferous useless stumps were the means by which the Chinese patriarchs saw to it that their girls and women would never run around. You know, you can see there's a picture of this. Here's a X-ray of what this looks like even today, basically crippling these women to make them subservient to men. You're like, well, okay, maybe the problem is religion. Maybe we need to look at secular worldviews. Not so. Often just as bad. Look at Nietzsche on this. This is just over 100 years ago. He says, woman is not capable of friendship. Women are still always cats and birds. You know, like animal accompaniment. Or in the best case, cows. Everything in woman is a riddle. And everything in woman hath one answer. Its name is childbearing. Man shall be educated for war, and woman for the recreation of the warrior. Everything else is folly. Man's happiness, I will. Woman's happiness, he will. Thou goest to women, remember thy whip. Let's look at Christianity, though, you know. Some quotes from early church fathers. Are we going to see any better here? Here's Jerome, the church father. As long as woman is for birth and children, she is as different from man as body is from soul. But when she wishes to serve Christ more than the world, then she will cease to be a woman and will be called a man. Or John of Damascene, woman is a wicked she-ass, a hideous tapeworm, the advanced post of hell. They would have these long sermons where they would rant against women because women brought sin into the world, and how Satan went after her because he knew he couldn't fool the man into rebelling against God and stuff. And they failed to mention that Adam was standing right there the entire time when Eve sinned. And the fact that Scripture usually blames Adam for that failure. But, you know, it's just women have really gotten a raw deal throughout history. And we need to evaluate the Bible's view up against, ancient and even relatively modern, recent views of women. So how do other worldviews treat women? The other thing we need to understand is that modern people are rightly cynical toward the idea of leadership and suspicious of claims of the wife submitting to the husband. It's not that hard to find an example of a man, you know, in a marriage, you know, using his position oppressively. You know, I've found a few pictures where this seems to be happening, like this one right here. Row harder, baby. She better move forward in the boat a little bit more, too. Or this one right here. Carrying the big case there. Must need to drink. She probably needs to drink a lot to be married to that guy. Or this one right here is my favorite. He's got the umbrella and the beer. She's got supplies for the rest of the week. So, you know, cynicism toward leadership is rightly deserved in a lot of cases. Really, we need to ask this question right here. How does the Bible define leadership and submission? When it calls on men to lead in marriage, and when it calls on wives to submit in marriage, what is it talking about? I think it's helpful to say, first of all, what it's not talking about. It's not talking about inequality. It's not saying that women are not equal to men. You know, we read Galatians 3:28 last week, where Paul writes, there is neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. That when we come to Christ, none of us are good enough. None of us are worthy of a relationship with Him. And we all enter heaven, crawling down on our knees through the doggy door of grace, totally unworthy of it and receiving a handout from God. And so in God's eyes, you know, all are equal, of equal worth and of equal value. You know, like I said, a little bit later in this passage, Peter is going to call the wife a co-heir of eternal life with the husband. And so he views them right on equal level with each other. Just because they might have a different function in marriage, relationship, does not mean that the woman is any less equal or inferior in any way to the man. Also, it's not that women submit to all men. Some men will take passages like this and say, all women need to submit. And that's not what he says. He says, wives, submit to your husbands. For example, in Ephesians 5:22 that I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, and it's a special relationship, you know, where he turns around and he calls on the husband to love the wife as Christ loved the church. And so not all women are supposed to submit to all men, and not all men are supposed to give their lives sacrificially for all women. It's a special unity that and commitment that you share in marriage. It's also servant leadership that the man is being called to, and it's based on Jesus' example. Like Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. How did Christ love the church? Well, Christ was the one who thought of giving up his privileges, his secure position in heaven, to come down, enter the human race, to take abuse for his entire life, finally paying the ultimate penalty of dying on the cross, and so that he could offer forgiveness and eternal life. He took spiritual initiative. He took the pain so that we could gain. And that's what he's calling on the husband to do. Christ says in Mark 10, he says, the way you guys lead, this is not to be the way of the world. You know, that we know how the rulers of this world, they lord it over those who they're in authority over. You know, you picture the image of the boss with his hands behind his back, hands behind his head and his feet up on the desk, barking out orders to this person and that person. And, you know, you work your way up the totem pole so that you can get paid more and do less. And he says, that's not the way it is. He says, the way up is down. You know, if you want to be great, Jesus says, you need to become the servant of all. Because he says, again, in Mark 10, he says, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so it's a tall order that he's calling men to here. Finally, God is the ultimate authority. So he's not saying that wives, you know, you need to submit to your husbands even if he's calling on you to do something immoral, because God is your ultimate authority. You know, he trumps things your husbands might tell you to do. And so while there's definitely gray areas here, and this would have been complicated as to how they were going to work out this idea of submission in the context of being married to, you know, in some of these cases, a non-Christian husband, you know, they still needed to remember that God is their ultimate authority. And so any time that they would need to not do what their husband tells them to do, to disobey, it would be done with respect and gentleness and not with just a real, you know, in-your-face attitude. Kind of like we see Peter in Acts 5:29 and the rest of the apostles, where they're like, look, you can't tell people about Jesus. And they're like, dude, should we obey you or God? We're going to have to obey God every time if we're given that choice. And so how does submission and leadership in marriage play out in a practical way? Well, he mentions some here, like, you know, respect. That's one thing that wives can show their husbands that guys have a lot more of a need for than most women even realize. You know, this comes out sometimes in decision making. You know, if you're just at a gridlock where you just can't make a decision and you've got to move forward on something, you know, the husband is basically called upon to make the call and to do it in as sacrificially loving of a way as possible. And so it's just like, if at all possible, let's just let her have her way. And that's the kind of leadership that the husband is called upon to take in a marriage like that. Also, the husband seems to have some sort of a special responsibility to initiate. It's like he's got more responsibility for the marriage. It's like when you stand before God someday, God's going to ask you specifically, how did you manage your marriage and your family? And you're going to have to give an account for that. In my marriage, it's hard to even pinpoint ways that this practically plays out. You know, it's not like there's all these power struggles and I'm like, woman, submit to me. One way I did see it play out, though, early in our marriage, actually during our engagement, was this story here. So when I proposed to my wife, all right, you know, it was this like really nice, big, elaborate date. You know, it's like if you're a guy, it's like I've got to plan the biggest date that I've ever planned and ever will plan again. And so I took her down to Cincinnati, which is where I'm from, and we kind of hung out with my family some, and then we went out to eat at this really nice place on the river, and then I took her to this park, and I proposed to her, and she said yes. And so at that moment, I think I made kind of a mistake. You know, this is maybe 20 minutes after we got engaged, and we're getting in the car to head back to, you know, celebrate with my family and stuff. And I was like, and so she, you know, she's just still starry-eyed and stuff and looking at the ring. And I was like, hey, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, when do we want to get married? And we were thinking of kind of a, you know, a shorter engagement window, which was going to mean there's going to be a lot to do. And I was like, oh, by the way, I'd like to buy a house. And I went out and got pre-approved for a mortgage, and I just need your W-2s. It's the Risley Guide to Romance right there. And so, you know, she's completely overwhelmed by this, you know, and I'm kind of like reacting like, wait, what, you know, you're not into this? And, you know, this is a good financial investment. And so it kind of became this thing where, you know, for the next month or so, every time it came up, it was a point of tension where she just felt completely overwhelmed by everything. And I'm just like trying to push this really hard to get this done on top of everything else. You know, it was interesting, though, because there came a point where she finally came and sat down with me, and she was like, okay, I've been praying about this, and, you know, even though I feel kind of uncomfortable by this and overwhelmed by the whole thing, I've decided that what I'm going to do is I'm going to trust your leadership here, and I'm going to trust you to make the right decision for our family. And here's some of my concerns with this whole thing, but I'm just going to put this in your hands, and I'm going to get behind whatever you decide to do. And so I was like, whoa. I just totally got out spiritualed by my wife. And that completely changed the direction of the entire conflict. You know, it was like, it's basically, in these kind of conflicts, it's like whoever's most spiritually mature needs to take the first step toward laying down their rights and getting their way. And start doing relationships the way that God calls on us to do relationships. And it's amazing the impact that that will have on your relationships in general, but on your marriage in particular. And so, it's going to look different from couple to couple as well. There's certain things that would be cool for one couple that would not be cool for another couple that would feel, you know, real disrespectful or whatever. And that's kind of, you know, Peter doesn't get into too many specifics here. He kind of lays out the general principles here. And then leaves that for, you know, the individuals involved to work out. He goes on, though, to give some more instruction to wives along these lines. He says, you know, ladies, your adornment must not be merely external. Braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses. Okay, so he's not forbidding the wearing of makeup or jewelry or nice clothes. You know, it says merely external. The merely is not in the original text, but that's certainly the sense of what he's talking about here. You know, if we didn't take it that way, you know, the word dresses is literally just clothes, okay? So he's not forbidding women to put on any clothes and that's like beautiful somehow. He's saying, you know, what he's really saying here is, you know, he's trying to get them to avoid suspicion from their unbelieving husband. You know, makeup in the first century AD, Jobs goes through source materials on this, the commentator I read earlier, but she shows how makeup was viewed as deceptive. Which, it kind of is. that's kind of the point, is to hide things or whatever. But, you know, it's, imagine, this wife who's a new believer, her husband's not interested, they've already had some fights about it. And then, you know, she's walking through the living room, you know, she's just decked out, you know, she's got all her makeup on, she's got her hair all done up real nice, she's dressed like she's going down to the club. And he's like, where are you going, honey? She's like, oh, I'm just going to home church, you know, to talk to a bunch of men that you don't even know and aren't interested in becoming part of this new religion. And, you know, that would have generated a lot of suspicion. And so part of what he's trying to do is, again, to try to heal this rift that is developing between believing wives and their unbelieving husbands, and to try to avoid casting suspicion in general on this movement. But he's also critiquing the world's superficial, arbitrary view of beauty. You know, he's saying your focus should not be on what the world calls beauty. And I've got a short little one-minute video that some of you have probably seen, which I think draws this out pretty nicely. Pretty normal looking girl. Time lapse, obviously. Not good enough yet, though. Photoshop. So that's what you're seeing in the magazines and on the billboards. You know, it's a team of highly paid cosmetic consultants, as well as extensive video or photo editing to try to attain this view of beauty. And then, you know, the rest of us are sitting around feeling like crap because we don't look like that girl on the bulletin board, on the billboard, or the guys on the billboards and on the magazines. And in reality, nobody looks like that. Not even the guy on the magazine looks like the guy on the magazine. Not even close. And so Peter says, maybe you should get into a different kind of beauty, ladies. He says, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. You know, gentle, you know, Jesus says, you know, learn from me because I'm gentle and humble in spirit. It's that same word. And, you know, quiet, it doesn't mean like you shouldn't talk. It's, you know, a quiet spirit. That's something that's even advocated as a virtue that men should have in other places in the New Testament. And so, you know, it's over against kind of a loud, abrasive, selfish, taking, self-promoting kind of spirit. You know, there's a humility to this. There's a gentleness here. There's a kindness here that he's advocating. And he says, that's imperishable, you know. The other view of beauty is going to fade away. But this beauty right here, this character, he says, that's really what you should be trying to cultivate. And not only is that, you know, going to be pretty cool to your husband, to show him a different kind of beauty, but that's really precious in the sight of God. Application for this, for the girls, you can ask yourself these questions. What kind of beauty are you cultivating? Where is your focus? Where is your energy going toward? Also, what are you trying to draw attention to? You know, if you ask girls, you know, how do you want guys to view you? You know, they'd probably say, you know, I want them to respect me. I want them to love me. I want him to, you know, really think highly of me. I want him to, you know, admire. Christian girls here might say, I want him to admire me for my godly character. And yet, what are my actions and my wardrobe and stuff? You know, what is that? What is that communicating that I want guys to notice about me? Also, what kind of guy are you hoping to attract? Are you looking to attract a shallow, superficial dude who's most interested in how hot you are? Or, you know, it's not that there's any problem with looking good, but, you know, what are you hoping will be the main reason this guy's interested in you? You know, that's part of the problem. It might be the cause of some of your insecurity in your romantic relationships is because you know that your beauty is fading and will fade. If this is all he's interested in, then what's he going to think when it's gone? Guys, what are you looking for in a woman? You know, which beauty do you have in mind? Do you have the one that our world holds forth? Or do you have this kind that Peter's talking about right here? Are you looking for godly character? You know, you might be saying to yourself, and I know this sounds kind of crass, but, you know, some guys might think to themselves, you know, what I really need to find is a hot chick because, you know, she can always become spiritual later. But, you know, if she's spiritual, there's a chance, you know, she probably won't get hot later. And so, and of course, the poor idiot is using the world's view of beauty when he makes that assessment. You know, here's the reality. Whatever quote-unquote hotness she has, that will pass away, as will yours. You know, that's Proverbs 31. It says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. It's fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. You know, it would be pretty sad, you know, if she lacks godly character, do you really think she'll develop it later? Probably not. There's a pretty good chance that she won't. You know her physical beauty, you know, that, you know, especially by the standard you're probably evaluating that against, that's going to go away. That's going to fade. And then you're going to be left with the person that you married, okay, not the image that you married. The character piece, even if she retains that beauty that you're so enamored with, she's not going to look that attractive if, you know, she doesn't respect you at all, if you can't get along with her, if she's flirting with other guys and even going out on you. You know, that beauty, that's going to become pretty unattractive pretty quickly. So don't be a fool and look at the wrong beauty. On the other hand, if she's got godly character, then that's probably just going to get better and better as the relationship goes on. And you might be surprised at how beautiful she becomes as you get to know that part of her. It's hard to explain, but this is true, and you can talk to happily married guys and they'll tell you the same thing. So go for the right kind of beauty, the kind that Peter's talking about here. Imperishable, not fading. And then he gives an example. He says, in this way, in the former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you become her children if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear. So that's kind of a weird statement, Sarah calling him Lord. It's a reference to Genesis 18. After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. So this is where Sarah's 90, Abraham's almost 100. They've never been able to have kids. And God shows up and says, you guys are going to have a kid by this time next year. And Sarah is off by herself. She overhears the conversation. She laughs to herself and she's like, seriously, I'm going to have a child? I'm so old. And my Lord is old as well. You know, so what's she doing here? Well, she's talking about her husband respectfully. You know, it's not like, yeah, that idiot who's failed to get me pregnant thus far. Women can talk pretty meanly about their husband's faults. And here she is. She's even by herself here, but she's, you know, thinking respectfully about him. You know, it's kind of a title of respect. The very next chapter, it's you see just one guy meets these couple of dudes, and he's like, oh, my lord, will you come and stay in my house for the night? So kind of a, it seems like it was a title for respect back then as well. I definitely don't want my wife to call me Lord. I know that much. But she's talking respectfully about her husband. And just kind of the general pattern of following his leadership, you know, in Genesis 12, it's pretty late in life when we meet Abraham and Sarah. You know, she's in her 60s, he's 75. God says, I want you to leave everything and I want you to go to a land that I'm going to show you. Despite the insecurity that would have brought into their lives, she willingly packed up and followed him to the promised land and lived there with him. So he's probably just in general talking about her general attitude of submissiveness toward her husband and extolling that and saying, you girls could maybe have something to learn from these holy women of the past. And then he turns to the men. And he says, you husbands, in the same way, so this is all in the same way, you know, so he's pointing back to the example of Christ, the example of other-centeredness and sacrificial love. He says, live with your wives in an understanding way, as someone weaker, or as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. All right, well, this middle clause sounds pretty offensive, as with someone weaker, since she's a woman. What's he talking about there? Well, I think it's just a general principle. I mean, women are physically weaker than men. In general, you know, there are some exceptions. Like that. Like that girl. Not a weaker vessel. You know, I mean, in that culture, too, the woman would have also been real disadvantaged in a lot of other ways as well. And so he's trying to tell the husband, look, you need to relate to your wife in a way that's sensitive and understanding because, you know, you're stronger than her, you're probably tougher than her, you've also got a lot more advantages than her. And so you need to understand what it's like to be coming from her perspective. And you need to be sensitive and gentle with her and compassionate, not just telling her to suck it up and quit whining so much. He says, and you need to show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. And so he refers to her, even though she's weaker physically, when it comes to God's eyes, she's a fellow heir of the grace of life. And how do we show honor? Well, guys, there's a number of ways you can do that. If you're married, or if you're not married, you can start now by learning how to become the kind of person that can treat women in this way, and you can even treat women this way now. You know, for one, there's sexually. This is, you're faithful in every way. You know, you're not the checkout porno guy. You're not the checkout other girls guy. You know, if you're dating, you're not pressuring her physically. It's sexually. Trying to push the envelope at every possible chance. Totally out of control. Also sensitive to her in this area once you are married and can have sex according to the way God intended it. There's also physically. This is where you're gentle with her. You're not rough physically. Your anger is under control. You know, when you get close to somebody in marriage, sometimes it can really, you might find new levels of anger that you never even knew you had before. You know, I didn't even think I had an anger problem until I got married. And I was surprised at some of the, you know, the angry feelings that would surge up in me as I would be in conflict with my wife. If you're the kind of guy that, you know, gets physically violent when you get angry, you need to think twice before moving toward marriage. And if you're the kind of girl that's in a relationship with a guy that will physically hurt you, you need to run. Run away. For your sake, for the sake of your life, for the sake of your children's lives, you know, even if he blames you, even if he apologizes and cries, even if he tries to say it was your fault, that is not the kind of guy that's doing what Peter's calling on you, on him to do here, showing her honor, showing you honor. You don't have to settle for that. Verbally honoring her. So this is how you speak to her. Also how you talk to people about her. You know, with your words, you're honoring her. You're encouraging her regularly. You're expressing appreciation regularly for her, for what she does, for who she is. Generally affirming when it comes to the way that you speak to her and about her. You're honoring her in conflict. This is, you're not throwing the tantrum. And, you know, holding your breath till you turn blue and punishing her. You're learning how to resolve conflict in a mature way, and you're even taking the leadership in conflict resolution. Your words are under control. There's things in marriage you cannot say that you will feel like saying in a conflict. And I hear about marriages where people say things that I'm like, you know, I don't know if you could ever forget that if you said that to your spouse. You need to have respect for the damage that you can do. Especially be careful when you're in conflict. Also considering her needs. You know, if I'm going to bring up an issue here, have I thought about, is this a good time to do it? Is this even that important of an issue to bring up? How could I bring this up in a way that she's going to be able to respond to this in a positive way? I'm taking responsibility even for the tone of this conversation, where I'm just going to dump on her and then expect her to deal with my infantile emotions, but where I'm going to, you know, lay things out in a way that is not just vomiting all over her. Also apologizing. Hopefully we can, you know, be mature enough to be the first one to get there on the apology in every case if there's something you need to apologize for. You honor her emotionally. This is where you learn how to explore her feelings. It's super important, probably more important to girls than guys. Also sharing about your own feelings in a way that's constructive and healthy and edifying. Financially, you honor her. This is where you get a job where you can provide. You're working on that now, even if you're not married. We're not just thinking, well, hopefully I marry a woman with a good job and a lot of money, so, you know, so I can be a stay-at-home dad someday. I'm just so good with kids. No, we're looking to provide for our family. We're working hard to do that. Also, we're generous toward her. You know, we're not super stingy and giving her a hard time for, you know, taking too long of a shower or something like that. But we're, you know, we're being generous, and we're being maybe stingy toward ourselves, frugal toward ourselves, but generous toward our wives. Practically, you know, some guys, they just sit there zoned out in front of the TV, and they never do anything to help. This is, you're helping out around the house. You're planning for things. Your life is not a mess, but you've got your life basically in order. Learning how to fix stuff. I had to do that once I got married, learn how to fix things. And spiritually, honoring her by taking spiritual leadership in this relationship. So you're praying for her. You're praying with her. Chicks love it when you pray with them. Let me just say that right now, okay, guys? Initiating spiritually, talking about spiritual things, trying to set a spiritual tone for your relationship. Maybe she'll be spiritual, but whatever. Your job is to try to is try to make this relationship centered on God, you know, a cord of three strands where it's you and her and Christ. And that's what our relationship is wrapped around and built upon. And he says you need to do this so your prayers will not be hindered. And some guys are like, man, why would it hinder my prayers if I'm not nice to my wife? Well, the reason is because God loves his daughters. And you kind of have to be a dad with a daughter of your own to really appreciate the force of this verse right here. You know, here's my daughter, okay? She just turned 5. When God looks down at his girls, and he's like, so you really expect to tell me that you want to neglect and abuse, mistreat my daughters, and then come and ask me for something? He says, I'm not going to answer that prayer. You know, imagine a guy coming to me, hey, Mr. Risley. I'd really like to take your daughter out. So I was wondering if I could borrow your car, because, you know, I don't have one of my own, and I'm thinking about bringing my buddies along so we can just ride around and just kind of put her in the back seat and ignore her and make cracks about women all night long, and if you could give us some money for food, too, that would be great. Then later I'm hoping to take my buddies home and then try to pressure your daughter to having sex with me in the back seat of that car. So where's the keys? You think I'm likely to answer that prayer? You think I'm likely to let him borrow my car? I'd say, you can borrow my baseball bat with your face. If you want to get anything from me, son, you need to treat my daughter with the respect and honor that she deserves. You need to do at least as well as I've done with her. And he goes on finally and says, to sum up, all of you, be harmonious. This is everybody, not just men, not just women, not just, you know, whatever position you're in. Harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. Not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. Like Jesus said, it's better to give than to receive. That's why God calls on you to bless other people when you're cursed. Why he calls on you not to retaliate, but to give, to love. To be the kind of person that he's talking about here, to interact in that way. That is the kind of witness that we need to offer up to this watching world. That's how we're gonna do our job. And, you know, frankly, for Peter's readers, persecution just offered a way, an avenue to be an even more powerful witness as they love their enemies, like Jesus said. So in conclusion, the Bible does have a high view of women, in fact. A view that was revolutionary for its time and was the foundation, really, for advances in women's rights even up to this present day. The Bible calls for a different approach to marriage. You know, the postmodern view where I just take, and any view of authority is viewed as oppressive and destructive. You know, maybe that has something to do with why marriage does not work in this culture. Maybe we need a different approach to marriage. Maybe we need one a little bit more like what God advocates in Scripture. Not one where I'm taking all I can, but one where both parties are willingly laying down their rights, where the husband is taking, more of a leadership role, and the wife is seeking to submit and respect her husband, as appropriate. Successful marriages are really going to stand out in this world. Successful marriages are really going to stand out in this world. This is something that people want. Young people, single people, they want, by some surveys, more than anything, they want to have a successful marriage someday and a successful family. And yet, increasingly, people are just giving up on marriage. They're giving up on family. If we can have healthy marriages, we can show them something different. You know, these wives that Peter's talking to, they certainly had a chance to show something different to their unbelieving husbands. And finally, I know that most of us aren't married, but you can start now by becoming the right kind of person. And that means if you're not a Christian, it means you become a Christian. And you experience the love of God so that you can love other people in the way that Christ calls on us to love other people. And if you are a Christian, you need to really, learning to love people in general, learning to build deep relationships is the best thing you can do for your future marriage. And it's also the best quality that you can find in a prospective spouse that you're considering marrying. So, you know, that's something that we can work hard on now, practicing the kind of things that Peter's talking about here in verses 8 and 9. Yeah, Lord, you say in your word that there's a way that seems right to humans, but in the end it leads to death. And relationships are one key area that we see that playing out right before our very eyes. I pray, Lord, that we could take Peter's teaching here to heart and that we would become the kind of person that he's talking about here. I pray for those of us that are married that we would live out the kind of marriage that he's talking about here. And I pray for people that are not believers here, Lord, that are not Christians. I pray that they would come to you and encounter your love so that they can have the power, the basis for loving others, for building successful marriages, for building successful relationships, and one day building a successful marriage. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.